Health Committee on Human Services. On Wednesday, March 16th, 2011, we're going out of order today for various reasons. We're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3220. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3220 allows the Oregon State Board of Nursing to use nursing assistant examination results for continuing education purposes.
Okay, and we have some people signed up.
Here's the sign-up sheet.
Thank you. So we have Representative Freeman, please, Holly Mercer, and Pam Ruono. Am I anywhere close? Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead, Representative.
Kind of tee it up. I'll get started here and not say very much because they're really smart people next to me. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman. I'm a House of Representatives member from House District 2, and I'm here today, Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam, to bring you just a very simple bill that's could be described as a technical fix. I had a little personal experience that brought this need to my attention, and I'm hoping to fix it with the help of the Board of Nursing. All it does is allows students to see the results of testing. And let me explain to you why that could be very helpful. I'll tell you a little personal story. My daughter went through a CNA program as a junior. That's a certified nursing assistant program. As a junior in high school, along with about 22 other students, at the end of the written portion, almost all of them got 100% on the written test. A group of them went for the skills test, and every single one of them failed. We heard that it might be a good idea the next weekend to take a group to Eugene to take a test. We took about 16 of them to Eugene the next weekend, and every one of them passed. There was no way to find out if there was a problem with the tester or the test or what it was they failed when they took the test. The law does not allow for the results to be released. This would allow for that. And in allowing for that, it would do a couple things. One, it would help those that are trying to become educated and get into the healthcare workforce better understand where their deficiencies are for a learning tool so they could succeed. And two, it would allow the Board of Nursing to check the testers. The testing is done under contract and with third-party contractors. And the way it is now, that they can look at the rate of failure. There's several measurements, but what they can't look at is the test results. So this bill here would simply allow those results to be looked at for those two reasons and should actually help us keep people in the pipeline to be healthcare providers.
Thank you very much, Representative. Can you stick around for a minute and we'll have questions after the panel? Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm going to give my testimony to you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director of the Board of Nursing. For those of you who are not familiar with the Board of Nursing, we are the largest healthcare board, licensing around 70,000 licensees, 50,000 nurses, and 20,000 CNAs, certified nursing assistants. As Representative Freeman conveyed, this bill actually creates the ability for the Board of Nursing to assist our nursing assistant applicants as they go through the testing process. And this bill removes a barrier that we have felt for years that actually resulted from guidance from the Department of Justice that said under the public records law that in order to have the sanctity of a test, that we could not convey the test results to our applicants. We have felt that this has been a barrier for years. We think it's time to make a change. We need nursing assistants in our workforce, and we need to remove this very important barrier. So we would encourage your passage of this bill. It's time to open up this workforce. We are all going to need those valuable people in our lives as we age. So we encourage passage. We are open to any questions that you have.
Great,
thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee. My name is Pam Rona. I am the Director of Policy and Programs for the Oregon Healthcare Association. The Oregon Healthcare Association is a statewide nonprofit trade association, and several of our members are nursing facility owners and have nursing assistant training programs that they use to train their employees. We feel that this House Bill 3220 would go a long way in assisting them, because when they take these state exams, the didactic portion or the written portion of the exams tends to have high passage rate. It's a skills testing area where the students have the hardest time, and it would be such valuable learning experience for them to understand where they, what steps they missed in taking those, in taking the skills, because we want them to, number one, learn from their mistakes, and number two, to be really good CNAs. And we need them in our workforce, so we urge you to support this very important bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of this panel? I see. Is that a sign? Got it.
Representative. Thank you, Madam
You're
Chair.
You're welcome.
Just about language. You want to use the way it is written, board may use the results of a nursing assistant examination for the continuing education of nursing students. This is continuing education does not have any connection with continuing medical education, continuing nursing education, continuing legal education. Correct, Amundo?
Co-chairs.
Sorry, it's early in the morning for that language.
No. Co-chairs and Representative Parker, you are exactly correct. This is not a formal continuing education designation. This is to help them get through their next retake on the exam. Thank you.
Representative Greenman had his name hand up first.
I was just curious why you can't do this without a change in law.
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlech, the reason that we decided that we had to go into statutory change is because we had actually two opinions, two interpretations that were the same from the Department of Justice, that under the public records law, we could not reveal the exact steps of these skills that were missed by the CNAs, in that there is a specific provision that protects the testing process for licensing agencies. And we are a licensing agency. So we want to make it very transparent that we want to give this information, and that's why we went through the statutory process.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
So you're saying some attorney told you that public record laws do not allow you to give a person the information from their own test?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlech, that is correct. We have had two guidance letters, actually, from the Department of Justice, and that's why we went to the length of changing the statute.
Madam Chair, I'd certainly like to have the person that wrote that memo testify on this. That's sheer stupidity. It's unbelievable.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Representative Greenlech kind of hit mine on the first there, but I see Representative Freeman has some powerful representatives sponsored on this bill with him, co-sponsored, and I guess I'll just leave it at that, because Representative Greenlech got me not on the attorney testifying, but the other part is what I was going to ask.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Coach. I'm not saying you are responsible for knowing what's happening in all the other arms, but to Representative Greenlech's point, what do we know about other testing and that kind of a judgment from Justice?
No.
Other boards, other similar situations in the state.
Co-chairs, I actually don't know the answer to that. We could certainly find that out. The nursing test is a national test through the National Council of Boards of Nursing. There is actually not a skills test formally in the nursing test. That is through the clinical sites and through the clinical education of nurses. This, however, is actually a fairly detailed skills test, and each step, and Representative Freeman, when we had this discussion last biennium, I was fully prepared to explain to him the myriad, you know, steps that have to be covered. He was way ahead of me. He had gone over each of those steps with his daughter many times. He was very familiar with how difficult, in many ways, this skill step is for our CNA applicants. So I do think there's a variety of testing procedures that the licensing boards use.
I don't know the larger question. On this particular test, again, the people that are administering the test are a third party. In other words, the nursing board contracts with somebody. And in the case that I've dealt with, it happened to be a nurse that worked at one of our retirement facilities on the side, extra job, did this as a contract. And the fact that every single one of this entire class failed this test was a red flag for me. Now, I mean, I know oftentimes people hear, well, it's not my kid. Well, this wasn't the situation. It wasn't the entire class that many of them had gotten 100% on their written test. Then to find out there's a huge discrepancy between the folks that pass the written test and those that can pass the skills test really threw up another red flag for me. This simply lets the board use the information appropriately to check their contracting to make sure that they're not having a testing issue. And it also lets those CNAs that otherwise may, you know, like I say, 22 passed, 16 went the next weekend and passed the skills test. I don't know what happened to that other group of people. They may have said, hey, you know, healthcare isn't for me. They'd spent all that time and money and energy going through the education portion, and if not for this test, they could be in the workforce. Now I don't know what they're doing. And that's what we're trying to drive at here, is we just simply want to, I don't want anybody to be able to cheat the system or become CNAs without having the qualifications. But the last thing we want to do is put a barrier up that drives people away from this very important workforce need that we have in our state.
Madam Chair, I would just say I have no quarrel with this bill, but we may have a larger problem with a justice opinion. Isolated justice opinion that may affect lots of other folks taking tests in other areas.
Okay, any further questions?
Just if you may.
Yes, Representative Frederick.
Thank you. That was one of the concerns that I had, Representative Gilliam, and you've spoken to it a bit. The concern that folks will have will be, can you then just continue to take the test and figure out where things are and then get through? Maybe that's exactly what you want to be able to do, but in our culture, it's often you fail or you pass and then that's it. This is a different situation.
Yeah. Thank you for the question, Representative Frederick, Chair Tomei. This is a skills test. I mean, you actually have to go in and do it. It's not like you're going to get the answers on a piece of paper and be able to copy them onto a written test. Regardless of how you learn how to do these skills, if it's through trial and error, and it costs money to take the test, so it's not like you're just going to be doing it for fun. But if you do happen to have to take it once and you miss, and I'll give you one example. When a CNA enters a room, you're supposed to announce who you are, your name, and why you're there. Okay, well, in a testing situation with the same person you're doing these skills with, the first time you might remember to do that, but the next set of skills you may say, well, I already did that, and but yet you're being judged on that. And that simple mistake could be, I mean, I don't know, we don't know, that could be why you failed the test. And you know, most of us, when we walked into a room with a new person, would announce ourselves and introduce ourselves. But the way the testing's set up, you're with the same person through each test. So it's that type of stuff that, you know, could be failing or could be bigger. But regardless of what the reason is you failed the test, if you knew, you could learn that skill. And when you go back in, you can't have it written down. You know, there's no way to cheat the test. You have to do it. You know, it's much like a driving test. You know, you have to do it. So I'm not as much worried about on the skills test of somebody gaming the system and having unqualified people. I think it's just a great learning tool if they knew what it was they needed to do better.
Thank you very much. This is, by the way, a good example of the proficiency-based approach that people are taking in terms of education. Mm-hmm. So when you hear that phrase, that's what we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenlee, we have a huge agenda, and we have a lot of people here to testify. We can bring this again. It sounds like we need to have
another public hearing.
Sure, Representative.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Isn't continuing education usually viewed as after their nursing assistants? And in this case, would giving you the permission to use it for continuing education allow you to give them that information before they become nursing assistants?
Co-chairs and members of the committee and Representative Greenlee, the way that we've worded this is that, and I do want to make it very clear that this does not limit us to after they are certified. This would give us the ability to use it as a continue. I know there's a term of art, continuing education. This, though, we mean in the terms of providing feedback for these nursing assistants in terms of a retake of the test.
But are they nursing assistants before you certify them?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, no, they are not nursing assistants before we certify them. We are responsible for the certification of the applicants to become nursing assistants.
Thank you, Representative Freeman, for bringing this bill forward. It sounds like we need to do a little more research on this and see where this is going. We had hoped to have a possible work session today, but I think we're not quite ready for that. So I'm sorry to have to bring you back again. I hope you don't come from very far away.
No, it's easy. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I'm just upstairs.
Yeah, I saw you up there. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3220, and we will also carry over the it was only for public
hearing. Yeah, it was
public hearing. I'm thinking of another one. Thank you. Okay, with that, we'll close House Bill 3220. And we'll open up a public hearing. The next one has a possible work session.
Yes.
3037. And Jennifer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3037, in its original language, provided for an expansion of services through Oregon Project Independence, including in-home and community-based home care supportive services, health promotion services, information on immediate and long-range options, counseling, and transportation service options. You'll notice there is a dash one amendment. The dash one amendment restores the original language in the measure regarding the definition of authorized agency. We have received impact statements, both revenue and fiscal, indicating that there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great. Thank you very much. Representatives, come on up.
Might we also bring James?
Absolutely. So, colleagues, we had a hearing on this on the 28th of February, and James Tase was not able to attend, and so that's one of the reasons we're having the second hearing, is so that Mr. Tase can tell us about this legislation. And welcome Representative Beyer and Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam. Just to sort of set the table here and to remind you that you did, in fact, hear House Bill 3037 some time back, and I will also touch very briefly on the amendment that you have before you. As a reminder, the intent in this bill is to modernize the OPI statute, the Oregon Project Independence statute, to make it somewhat more all-encompassing, and to get to the kinds of services that research over the last several years that many of us have been doing indicates that are the key critical services for a population of aging individuals that we kind of roughly refer to as the pre-Medicaid population, individuals whom, if they go through their asset base quickly enough, might well become Medicaid-eligible individuals, and that we believe with other kinds of assistance we can avoid that. I want to emphasize, because of some of the conversations that have come to me, there is no intent whatsoever to change the kinds of services that are being delivered by the area agencies on aging, or the AAAs, or O4AD, or however it's referred to you. Eligibility continues to be broad-based to individuals over 60, and then there's some classifications regarding fiscal eligibility for for services that are either free or can be paid for. But it is simply kind of an effort to get away from the what I consider dated language that is in the current statute that refers to homemaker, housekeeper, chore, escort. Perhaps not the kind of language we want in the Oregon Project Independence Statute. And instead focuses on home care, supportive services, on support to community caregivers and other natural support systems, health promotion, healthy aging, fall prevention, options counseling so that people are helped to understand what's available out there and how they can most effectively meet their needs at the least cost. And then we added transportation options as an effort to help with the awareness that public transportation is a very important piece to aging in your community and in home. Those assistances are critical to the whole picture. So I'm going to let Representative Beyer speak to that piece of it. And just as a way of explanation, the amendment before you, there was some confusion when the language in Section 1, page 1, lines 7 and 8, was changed from an area in Agency on Aging to the terms to provide authorized services, and to clarify and clear up any of any potential misconceptions from that, we restored the original language to make sure that we were aware that we are still talking about the services provided, certainly by our area agencies on aging, the very fine services that they provide. Mr. Taves has an excellent take on this whole situation. He and I have been working closely for years, and I wanted him to share his reasoning, but I think perhaps first we should hear from Representative Beyer in terms of the transportation and transit piece of this, if you will.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and committee. A reminder that when we came to testify before, Representative Cowan and I had each been working on separate pieces of this puzzle for a number of years. I had been working on trying to get funding into transportation options for our senior and disabled population, and she'd been working on the service piece of this, and you know, run up against enough roadblocks, maybe two works better than one. So we joined together to work on this, and I'm very supportive of everything they're doing. We did raise in testimony some concerns about the language on transportation in this, that it might limit it just to people who are enrolled in OPI programs, and that was a concern to us, but we couldn't really find any way to fix this bill, and there is no revenue attached to the bill at this point, so we think it's important that it at least acknowledges that this is an important piece of services to senior and disabled, and being able to stay in your home, and so I am supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative. James, can you stay for a minute until after James speaks? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Mr. Taves.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Programs. I'll be very brief. Over 80%, in fact, almost 85% of all seniors who need some type of long-term care support, which is activities of daily living, actually receive that from relatives, family members, friends, and not through state agencies or local agencies or any kind of paid public assistance. So the vast majority of care is provided by, again, families and natural resources, and less than 15% actually have spent down to Medicaid, need public assistance with their long-term care, whether it's in-home care or facility-based care. And that's a very important demographic issue to look at as we think about this population doubling in size over the next 20 years, and the fastest growing cohort of that group will be the 85-plus population. So the needs for long-term care are simply going to explode within the next 10 to 20 years. And we're struggling, obviously, right now with continuing funding for our existing system, much less anticipating the huge growth that this will require. So anything and everything we can do to keep people independent, healthy, and safe in their own homes is absolutely a priority for all of us, not only to bend the cost curve but also to keep people in the place that they want to be anyway, which is at home and independent, using their own resources, not being required to spend down. OPI, I see as a very important vehicle and potential vehicle to do that. The statute was written in 1975. At that time, Oregon basically had nursing homes, not much of a community-based system. OPI at that time was really targeted at individuals who were at risk of nursing home placement because they didn't have resources, they couldn't purchase in-home care otherwise, and it played a very important role in doing that. And actually now I would say OPI isn't really the vehicle that keeps people out of institutional care. We have 25,000 people in in-home care and facility-based care and assisted living and many other places that actually keeps them out of institutional care. What OPI does is keep people independent and healthy and safe before they have to spend down and require public assistance. And I think in modernizing the statute and looking at the range of services as they're redefined, it will still provide sort of the basic in-home benefit that's been traditional for Oregon Project Independence. It really stresses options counseling, which is something we're all focusing on now. Oregon has done a great job with our Medicaid system, but if you have a relative or a parent or a spouse in the hospital and they've broken their hip and they're about to be discharged and they're not Medicaid eligible, they don't necessarily have any direct access to someone who can sit down with the individual and the family on an immediate basis and really help them sort out their options. There's rarely a week or two that goes by I don't get a call from some relative out of state who has a parent or a relative in-state who faces an immediate health care crisis, and they're in the hospital, they're about to be discharged, they go on the web, they find my name, they call me. And again, we have failed to sort of organize the front door of this entire system for people before they actually require public assistance. So I think the strategies that are laid out in this bill, and of course there's no revenue attached to it, and in the governor's balanced budget, Oregon Project Independence, I think, is cut about in half from about $12 million to $6 million. So we're still going to struggle on the resource side. But the package of services that outlines as the policy and over time as we can better fund it really, I think, are the right services and the right strategy for Oregon as we look ahead to the demographic issues facing us.
Thank you so much. Any questions of anyone in this panel? Yes, Representative Widener.
One real quick, and it's for you, James. You said a lot of the cases you deal with are 85, is what I heard you say, or around the age of 85. In here it says age of 60. So I'm just wondering how much we're opening up with the age of 60, if that shouldn't be 65.
Madam Chair, Representative it's always been age 60. I mean, that's the tradition for the OPI program since its very inception. And, of course, there's lots of people in their 60s and 70s that also have significant long-term care needs, be they stroke victims or have other disabilities, chronic diseases and things of that sort. So it's not just the 85-plus population. And if you kind of look at the percentages of people at those age brackets who require long-term care, I think 60-plus, it's about 1 in 5. When you get to 75, it's about 2 out of 5 people need some form of long-term care assistance. And by the time you get to 85-plus, it's almost 1 out of 2 or 1 out of 1. So it escalates, obviously, very rapidly. But that doesn't mitigate the fact that you have younger people that have very significant long-term care challenges as well.
Madam Chair, if I might follow up on Representative's question as well. I think the confusion comes from 85 being a number that we use when we're describing the demographic and the rapid growth of the over 85 population, which is sort of looked at as a point where people are very likely to have an increased need for services, but it's not in relationship to the OPI eligibility. And the other piece that I just would like to remind the panel is that the service provision within the umbrella of Oregon Project Independence is not always services that are paid for through what little funds we put into that program, but there's a sliding scale eligibility, and individuals who have some level of resource may purchase those services for themselves. That's why the case management, the option counseling piece is so important, to help people understand that it isn't a simple step from I'm in this crisis and now I must move to a nursing home, which really gets back to the rather dated thought process we have from the 1970s when this was established, to the spectrum of care options that are available now in terms of private providers, private industry providers of in-home care services, assisted living facilities, adult foster care, and for those who have not yet experienced that particular stage in life or had an elder family member or friend experience that, people often don't understand, and it's just simply an opportunity to do what we commonly refer to as case management. In some cases, there are pilot programs that are referred to as ADRCs or Aging and Disability Resource Centers. There's a whole spectrum of ways in which we can help share that information more broadly so that people can make reasonable and responsible choices, often purchased from private businesses by those individuals, not necessarily exclusively provided to people for free.
Any further questions? Representative Gilliam.
I'll wait until
Representative Perry?
Yeah, I'll hold.
Okay.
Gilliam? Thank you, Co-Chair Tomei. Particularly glad that you're with us today, Mr. Taves. I was going over the budget note report of a little over a year ago. Just take my wife's glasses off here and put mine on. And
we'll look
can't see them, then you
I know, that's hard.
Oh, and it's just so substantially different. And I know it represents a lot of work by the colleagues I see in front of me. But to me, the budget note of a year ago and the report by the department, you know, focuses on core services. And now, and I'm not arguing that all of these aren't needed or there's not an argument for them, but it's really different. The bill really changes things. And I'm interested in your evaluation of that, and also, in light of our budget crisis, I mean, it is chicken or egg, and all of you have already articulated that. How do we provide more services in these times when there are less resources? But those things caught my eye, that the difference between what's in this bill now and just a year ago, a little over a year ago, what we were saying the program should focus on.
Co-Chair Gilliam, the budget note, and again, the core service of Oregon Project Independence has always been that intended kind of in-home benefit. And I think on average for people that get in-home services through OPI, it's roughly $200 a month, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. So it's a pretty limited benefit, but obviously very valuable for individuals. The reason for the budget note was concerns that the spending patterns varied very widely from one area of the state to the next, that we really ought to focus on a more standardized package of core services to assure that at least some level of the dollars went to the in-home package and weren't disproportionately spent on case management or other areas. And there was also a lot of concern. Senator Winters and others for years have said we ought to have not an asset test like we do for Medicaid, perhaps, but if you have a lot of wealth and housing, et cetera, that you should have some kind of asset test applied to that. So that was part of the equation as well. So I think that was the intent with responding to that budget note. But some of these other services are provided through Oregon Project Independence as an artifact of the case management dollars that are used in the program now. And if we said you must provide at least this amount of that budget for in-home, we wouldn't want to eviscerate the case management side because it does indirectly do some of these other functions now. I think the other thing that's very key for us is there is funding. I shouldn't say there's funding. There is appropriation language in the Federal Health Care Reform Act to support states in these kind of strategies for the aging demographic. And if it's appropriated, which quite frankly I doubt that it will be in this budget climate, but at least in that appropriation language, It appropriates those dollars through the Older American Act program, which is basically an 80-20 match. And so we have seen some light at the end of the tunnel, and people have always asked us, why can't you match this? And this is a general fund-only program. It's always on a hit list because it's general fund-only. And so we also looked at this as an opportunity to sort of sync up with a federal agenda that might allow us, hopefully at some point soon, and maybe even with existing Older American Act dollars, to use this as leverage and match. So that was part of the thinking as well.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Follow up.
Recognizing our schedule, I would just end my comment this way, which is if we are unable to get the funding for this, I think we can all agree we need to explore other ways, whether it's through the tax code or other kinds of ways to help seniors. We're all united on this. I'm with you. I don't know how this will fare in Ways and Means. That's not our job. So I have other questions, but I will hold them for another discussion in light of our...
Madam Chair.
There is not a referral to Ways and Means, right?
No, if I might address that, Madam Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam. This bill does not have a fiscal impact and will not be referred to Ways and Means. So let me make it clear that the intent here is to put a policy bill in place that allows us the flexibility wherever we might eventually find some funding, be that in another revenue process through this session or through federal funds or whatever else might wander along. The goal is to have a policy bill in place that allows us to be ready to take those opportunities where they come in order to deliver increased services to seniors. But this bill in and of itself does not put money into the system, does not have a fiscal impact. It's designed as the policy bill to be the vehicle ready for anything that may fall from the sky.
Thank you. I'm sorry I wasn't clear. I was really responding, Mr. Tabes.
Okay.
Larger question of how seniors are going to fare in the budget process. You're correct. This does not
happen. We share that joint concern.
Thank you. With that, we're going to have to close this, and we will not be having
Madam
work
Chair,
session.
Just yes, quickly, I apologize. I did not identify myself for the record, and I am Representative Terry Beyer. I represent House District 12, which is Springfield. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very
thank
much
you.
For coming today.
I think you did. I know I did.
With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3037. We'll carry over the possible work session, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2053. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2053 directs the Department of Human Services to provide to the Legislative Assembly a racial impact statement for legislative measures impacting child welfare clients in Oregon, child welfare data about race and ethnicity, and require child welfare contractors to use a percentage of their contracted funds from DHS for racial or ethnic populations that is equal to the percentage of the racial or ethnic population served by the contract.
Thank you, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. There was, I am so sorry, there was another woman who had signed up to testify. Could she raise her hand? You have that sign-up sheet. I did not mean to do that. Is she still here? Kay Metzger?
That would be me.
Can you stick around for just a little while?
It's fine if you're pressed for time.
If you'd stick around, I'll have this hearing, and then I'll come back to you. I'll open it up again. I'm so sorry. Okay. So we have a list of people who are wanting to testify on this. Erin Kelly-Seal and Mickey Cerise, and looks like she's bringing up somebody else. All right. Thank you for coming today.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Kelly-Seal. I'm the Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division and the Acting Director for the Department of Human Services. I did invite Michael Ware to come join me at the podium. He missed the sign-up sheet opportunity. He is the Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Equity and Disproportionality in Child Welfare, and I'm going to offer some perspective on House Bill 2053, which I am here to testify in support of, and then turn it over to Michael to talk with you a little bit about the task force and its work. In We've had conversation already in this committee about the department's priorities with respect to safely and equitably reducing the population of children in Oregon who have a foster care experience. If you remember when I was here before, we talked about the fact that there are about 13,000 plus children every year who have a foster care experience in this state. And I also shared with you that unfortunately, as compared to representation in the general population, African American and Native American children tend to be present in our foster care system at higher rates than they are present in the groups they represent generally in the population. This is something that the legislature has been talking to the department about for several years. And in 2009, you passed a bill creating, Senate Bill 630, creating creating the Child Welfare Equity and Disproportionality Task Force. That task force was comprised of 21 members and quickly grew in membership and support because of the extraordinary level of interest and the difficulty making sure that we adequately were representing the perspectives of all who were impacted by this particular conversation. What we learned very quickly was that this conversation was more than a long time in coming for many communities and groups across our state. We had people driving from Malheur County to come have the conversation with us about what it felt like, what it looked like to have inequitable and unfair treatment by the child welfare system. And by that I mean this. One of the first things that the Child Welfare Equity Task Force looked at was what are the root causes of overrepresentation and disproportionality in the child welfare system, and what does that look like as children make their way through our system? What we found very quickly was, yes, the child welfare system does receive more calls with respect to children of color than it does with respect to Caucasian children proportionately. But then when you drill deeper into the data around the particular decision points that the child welfare system and its partners are making about those children, we found that African American and Native American children are removed from their parents at higher rates than our Caucasian children. We found that they are placed in out-of-home placements at higher rates than our Caucasian children. We found that they stay in foster care longer than do Caucasian children. And those data were very disturbing on a variety of levels. They grounded us in a conversation about then kind of looking at what are the driving factors and what are then the recommendations to resolve those particular drivers. It was very clear to the task force that the solution wasn't just to focus on the child welfare system and its workers. They recognized we had representation from the Judicial Department, representation from the Oregon Youth Authority, from many other systems, from the education community, from the Oregon tribes. We had representation from providers, from the faith community. We had former foster youth. We had foster parents. We had lots of people at these tables, including many invited guests and many who came from, as I said earlier, a long way to share their perspective with us and what their experience in the foster care system was like. State Representative Mike Schaffler participated on the task force. So did Senator Martha Schrader. We then also had Representative Frederick present at many of our meetings, Representative Tina Kotek. There was a great deal of involvement, interest, and study that went into this work. House Bill 2053 represents one of the recommendations of the task force. What it does is attempt to institutionalize some of the recommendations coming from the task force and make certain that no matter who's in leadership in the department, no matter what the strategic agenda of the department may or may not be, that the department's efforts to reduce foster care equitably benefit all children. I want to make sure this committee hears that the committee's focus was particularly on children of color. But one of the other data points that was particularly disturbing for the committee and it is for the department is that as the department has been successful in reducing its foster care population over the last several years, up until 2010, we had very little success, in fact none, in terms of the reduction overall of children of color in the system. And what that spoke to us and said was we need to have both embedded across
different ways of doing our business for all children in the state, but we also need to recognize that for particular populations, the ways that we're doing business today are not working. And we need to change the way that we're doing that business so that all children equitably benefit from the improvements that the system is making. What House Bill 2053 does is really three things. First, it requires the department to provide you, the policymakers, with a racial impact statement regarding legislative bills that would otherwise impact child welfare clients. This is akin in some ways to a fiscal impact statement. It is not in any way designed to be the decision, but it's designed to give you better information about types of legislation that might benefit disproportionately or harm disproportionately particular population groups. This grew out of a conversation that we had about some of the unintended consequences that have not been examined in the past very closely around the disproportionate impact that some of our policies have on particular groups of kids. And the idea here really was to call the question, force analysis by the department about its own policy, but also the policy that's being recommended and decided on by the legislature, and facilitate through data a conversation about impact, particularly on kids of color who we know have been harmfully impacted by many policies in the past. The second piece, part of House Bill 2053, requires us to provide you child welfare data about race and ethnicity. Yes, we already do that. I think the issue here, though, is that up until 2 years ago, we did not. And the conversation in the task force around data became focused on the fact that if we are to become more data-driven, more performance-driven as an organization, we must create discipline around our ability to collect and report data, and not just collect and report it in the traditional ways that we always have in the past, but really to disaggregate data around particular groups, children of color, by gender. If you recall, there was a law about 10 or 12 years ago that required the department for the first time to report information out by gender, because at that time there was also a response feeling like the department's policies were not responding adequately to the different needs of boys and girls. And so really this is about creating and systematizing that requirement for us. There was also a conversation about the frustration that we, and often we hear from policymakers as well, have with respect to our ability to cross-compare data between systems. We collect data about race and ethnicity, and we report it differently, for instance, than does the Department of Education, than does the Oregon Youth Authority, than do other child-serving agencies. This makes it difficult for you as policymakers to compare apples to apples across the kinds of discussions that we're having with respect to, for example, the gap in educational performance by kids of color. And I think one of the things that this group aspires to have happen is that the data collection and reporting across multiple child-serving agencies would begin to align differently for you, so that when those various child-serving agencies report data out with respect to race and ethnicity, we do it in a similar fashion, so you can know that when one of us is talking about a Native American child, we're all talking about a Native American child. When one of us is talking about a Hispanic child, we're all talking about a Hispanic child, etc. This legislation doesn't impose requirements on other agencies right now. That's in order to reduce and avoid a fiscal impact up around this data collection reporting issue. But the idea is to create a foundational platform through the child welfare system around the way we collect and report data with respect to race and ethnicity, so that we can begin to have those other conversations with our sister agencies who serve kids and families. The third piece of the bill requires the department, is intended to require the department to put its money where its mouth is. One of the things that we discovered in the course of study with the task force is that we understand, for instance, around older youth in foster care, that unfortunately African American and Native American children have longer lengths of stay, and so they tend to represent a higher percentage of our youth who are exiting foster care. We then took a closer look at our services, primarily those that are federally funded in the independent living program, that we provide to older youth in foster care.
and we discovered that we were not proportionately providing services to the kids of color represented in that cohort of children. And so, in other words, we were serving the wrong group of kids. Not, I mean, that's not really what I mean to say. We weren't serving well enough the kids in that population who needed to be served. We weren't acknowledging with our resources that more kids of color were represented in that cohort. And so we had more kids who happened to be Caucasian receiving those services than we did the kids of color. And that's not okay. As originally written, that particular section of the bill actually held our contractors accountable, and that's why there is before you an amendment which we requested and we support to be certain that this is these are the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2053, that to be certain that Section 3 actually carries out the original intent, which is to require the department to bear responsibility and accountability for our funds that we're expending and not to impose additional reporting requirements or regulatory requirements on our contractors around that issue.
Aaron, staff just said we didn't get the Dash 1 amendments. I don't feel my packet either.
I got a quick question about there, Diana.
Go ahead.
Eric, will you go back just real quickly? You made a reference to our inability or our lack of serving kids that come out of the foster care program before they graduate. Did you make a reference to that? If you did, I want Representative Thompson to hear that.
Co-Chair Gilliam. Yeah. And Representative Thompson, I was referring to the services we offer to youth who are still in foster care but who are above a particular age. I believe it's 14, it may be 16. I could get you specifically, but we have an independent living program designed to facilitate and support positive transition by youth from foster care. And so that was the program I was talking about that we took a closer look at and recognized that there were that some of our kids of color weren't benefiting from that program when they should have been.
I think some of your kids of all colors are not benefiting.
And Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Thompson, I would agree with that. What is also true about that program is that it supports only about 30-35% of the kids who need the service. And so I think really what we're talking about here is within the resources that we have, just making sure that we're spending them equitably. So I wasn't meaning to suggest that we were adequately spending on that particular population.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I understand that Mickey Cerise has helped me by providing you with that Dash 1 amendment, and I do apologize for assuming that you already had it. It really, again, that Dash 1 amendment is simply intended to clarify what the original intent of the legislation was. We will still be monitoring how contractors use our funds, but the focus will be on our ability to do that monitoring and to hold ourselves accountable for the way that we're spending the resource. I do want to say that House Bill 2053 represents just a very small picture of the work that the task force has done, and there are many recommendations that do not require legislation and that the department is already working on and working toward. We did provide you today is the debut of that task force report, and you do have a copy, I hope, I'm not mistaken this time, of the executive summary of that report, as well as a complete set of the task force's recommendations. I also, in that summary, I also believe you have this piece of paper that gives you the citation to the full report, which is lengthy, and I just want to point out there was an extraordinary amount of work that was put into this body of work, and it is designed not to be something that we look at only once, but we hope to be back before you again and again around this conversation. It took us a long time to get to where we are, and we recognize that it's going to take sustained leadership, commitment, and involvement with our communities in order to move us forward on this issue. And so I do appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2053, and with that, I'd like to turn it over to Michael Ware, who was the chair of the Equity Task Force.
And colleagues, Ms. Kelly Seal is going to be having to leave us. She has another meeting at 9 o'clock. So I think if we have any questions for her, maybe we should put them in writing. We'll get them to her later, and she can come back at another time and respond. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you both.
Representative Torme, Representative Gilman, other representatives, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify this morning. And I'm just really here this morning to talk about the tremendous work that the task force.
Sorry, Mr. Ware, could you state your name for the record, please?
Michael Ware, chair of the Equity Task Force. I'm really here today to really talk about the membership of the task force and the work that we've done over the last 18 months. We had a tremendous, tremendous committee of committed citizens from Oregon, as Aaron has said, and we worked tirelessly for a long time to try to get this work done. Everybody had an opportunity, you know, to participate. I want to make, you know, a couple of things clear. I've submitted a letter to you with the report and also some written testimony relative to 2053. So I won't talk about that. But one of the things I will talk about is the importance of collecting this data, and which is really the framework for 2053 in collecting data that that really specifically talks about the needs of these particular children. With that bill, we'll be able to collect that data and understand it and be able to support the children with the financial support that they need to be successfully out of foster care. So thank you very much, and I'll entertain any questions.
Any questions of this witness? You've put in a lot of work here. I know how much time this has taken. I really, the whole committee appreciates what you've done. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We also have some other people who'd like to speak. Alberto Romero, Moreno, Tanya Sanchez, Vicky Lansing. I think we only have three chairs. And after that, we will hear from Mark Knudsen, Lon Getlin, and Midge Purnell, maybe. Okay, thank you for coming today. Mickey, did you not sign up? Did you want someone else to come with you? Is that why you were waiting? That's fine. Okay.
I'll just wait.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning, Honorable Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Migrant Health Coordinator for the Office of Multicultural Health and Services with the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2053. As many of you know, our state has undergone significant demographic changes in the last 10 years. In fact, according to newly released U.S. Census numbers, Oregon's Latino population surged 63%, I repeat, 63% in the last 10 years, largely fueling the state's 12% growth since 2000, according to those newly released U.S. Census figures. The robust gain of Oregon's Latino population is a story repeated across the country, joined by a 41% increase in the state's Asian population. The trend is helping to turn what was once a starkly white state into an increasingly diverse one. In fact, people identifying as more than one race grew 33%, making the number of Oregonians about 110,000, choosing the multiracial category, larger than both Black and Native American combined. Just 20 years ago, more than 9 of 10 Oregonians were white. Today, it is fewer than 8 in 10. As I travel the state through both urban and rural areas, it is clear that all of our communities are changing. These demographic changes carry policy and service delivery implications and suggest that as a state, we need to ensure that our programs, staff, and services also change to keep pace with our vibrant and ever-changing Oregon. Nowhere is this need more pronounced than within DHS Children, Adult, and Family Services Division. As you've heard from several advocates and program staff today, children of color and other cultural and racial minorities face disproportionate representation in both our judicial and foster care systems. Children of color, in fact, not only are overrepresented in foster care placements, but also in such key indicators as length of stay, as you've heard this morning. This over-adjudication of children of color into our foster care system and their subsequent longer than average length of stay are important metrics that suggest that our system of care is currently unable to provide the culturally and linguistically competent area of services to ensure speedy return of these children to their families. We are therefore supportive of House Bill 2053 because it provides us with the vehicle to be able to provide racial impact statements, but also because it creates a mechanism for us as a department to be able to track child welfare data by race and ethnicity. The Office of Multicultural Health and Services would support any and all efforts to build into this program the ability to not just track race and ethnicity, but language as well. This will allow us to ensure that these children who have unique language and cultural needs are placed in a foster care setting that most closely resembles their family of origin. This additional measure would help to ensure a speedier return to family and community, thereby reducing costs to the state. In closing, we respectfully recommend the legislature support this bill and ensure a more equitable adjudication of all of Oregon's children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Tomei Gilliam. My name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the Director of Family Services for the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland. I just want to offer just a few words of we are in support of the House Bill 2053. We feel it's a very important step towards working on this issue of disproportionality for specifically for Native American children in the state of Oregon. Part of the issue that is very concerning is the oftentimes an inability for people to recognize that there are Native children in the foster care system. I offer myself as an example. My last name is Sanchez, would indicate maybe that I was Hispanic. My father's family is from Texas, and there are only 3 federally recognized tribes in Texas because of issues with colonization and whatnot. So we're not federally recognized as a tribe. I'm Comecuro Carrizo from Texas. But so we ended up with a lot of Spanish surnames. So as a Native American, I would not necessarily be recognized as that. That's an ongoing issue that's happened in the child welfare system. So we really think this is a very, very important bill. Also just want to follow up on Aaron Kelly Seal's statement about the ILP. We're very concerned with the fact that many of our children are long-term in the child welfare system, and that does cause concern because then they don't have access. We have very limited access to that program. We have a person in our office who works with 25 children. That's really all that they can handle is the 25 children. That's the contract. And there are so many more Native children aging out of the foster care system that really need those services. And we just want to, reiterate that. It's just a very, very important part. Also want to recognize that certainly it is not just an urban issue. Many of the tribes are dealing with the same type of thing, needing to be able to provide services for their children, not necessarily having the information about numbers, not necessarily having the access to funds to be able to work on that. And the tribes are really important. They did play a big part in the disproportionality or equity study, and I think that's really, really an important piece of that. We definitely support the tribes in making all efforts to work with the DHS to deal with their children as well. We certainly, of course, recognize that they're not all in the urban areas. They're all over the state of Oregon. The disproportionality is not just in the urban areas. It's everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for anyone? Thank you so much. Thanks for all the work you put into this. With that, we'll call Mickey Lansing and Mark Knudsen. Go ahead, Mickey.
Good morning, co-chairs, Tomei, Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the executive director of the State Commission on Children and Families. I am here today to support the passage of House Bill 2053, requiring equity in child welfare in this state. In 2008, our agency was invited to participate in a symposium at Georgetown University, and at that point in time, a paper was presented, a very important paper, saying and stating, understanding racial and ethnic disparity in child welfare and juvenile justice is absolutely critical in this country today. This Chapin Hall research concluded that in order to be successful, the strategies to achieve equity and outcomes for children, youth, and families of color must must have the following components. There are three pieces to this. Number one, the need of political support from legislators and from judges. Your support is absolutely essential to be able to address this issue. Any plan to meet the challenges must involve both the families and the community. And three, it is imperative to have clear outcomes that have the support of the community, and that community support is absolutely essential. The recommendations of the Governor's Equity and Child Welfare Task Force are based on these same fundamental principles. Disparities in services produce disproportionate numbers of children in both child welfare and juvenile justice, and then that equates to the adult criminal justice system. The Commission has been a pioneer in the effort to bring greater racial equity to Oregon, and the State Commission on Children and Families wholeheartedly supports the passage of House Bill 2053, and we will support the Department of Human Services in their work in communities in any way possible. I also want to just say a very special thanks to the grandparents, to the parents, to the children and youth who were willing to have truly courageous conversations in these last 18 months of the work of the task force. These were not easy conversations. They were very difficult, not only for the families, but for the Department of Human Services and for other child-serving agencies. And they just did a fabulous job. I also want to thank the chair, Michael Ware, for his commitment to this particular process and the work that has been done over these 18 months. My belief is this is not a report that's going to go sit on the shelf. These recommendations, if passed and supported by you, are going to be implemented in the community, which is the place where they need to be implemented. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce to me Pastor Mark Knutson. Pastor Knutson has been the pastor for 15 years of Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland. The Reverend Knutson is a member of the State Commission on Children and Families and has truly worked tirelessly to ensure that the many cultures that live in this state are both heard, respected, and truly represented. His service at Augustana has to build a truly diverse, multicultural servant congregation.
Thank you, Becky. Representative Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Gilliam, and the members of the committee, thank you for this hearing today. As one who does a lot of interfaith work, I do want to say that in the synagogues and mosques and temples and churches in the city and state and around the state, you're lifted up in the prayers regularly, all of you, for the work you're doing, and thank you for the commitment you make.
Thank you, and you need to
My name is Mark Knutson, pastor of Augustana Lutheran Church.
Thank you so much.
In Portland, and we also lift up all those who work in state agencies in these very difficult times. As Mickey said, I'm a pastor of Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland, a multicultural, multinational congregation. And back in the 1980s, when I was doing national work, I served on a national task force of the Lutheran Church, 5.5 million members, 11,000 congregations, on these precise issues, especially on what it means to live in and fully be a multicultural, multiracial society, and the joy that is in that. But it takes vision and intentional steps. I served as a member of the Governor's Task Force on Equity and Disproportionality in Child Welfare, and I come before you strongly urging you for the passage of House Bill 2053. As you are all aware, disparities and inequities in policy and practice due to race cut across every sector of our society, from housing to healthcare, from education to employment. It is well documented that there is a high degree of overrepresentation of communities of color in the child welfare system in Oregon and our juvenile system. This overrepresentation is due in great part to historical and current practices and policies. This poses tremendous risk to our children and our communities, as well as a major social and moral dilemma for the state. As a pastor in a diverse community and a congregation, I could share many stories of children and families in this state, especially those who are most vulnerable. As Michael Ware, chair of our task force, shared, the task force brought together a cross-section of the state of leaders from a number of communities, foster parents, grandparents, family members, members of state agencies, and it was an incredible conversation. We looked at data, we looked at best practices and outcomes, but what was most compelling were the stories. And as you know, those stories just hit you right in the heart and soul. You will find many of the recommendations of the task force report that has come forward will have minimal impact on state budgets. Indeed, most will have great savings in the long run, and we'd encourage that to be reinvested in children and families in the state. But even if they double our current budget, even if they double it, the issues are so morally compelling that it would be incumbent on each of us to put our careers on the line to do what is necessary to find resources to implement them, for lives and futures are at stake. But I'll go back to the original point. The impact will not be that great in terms of doubling. I come out of a tradition. I know many of you are people of great goodwill where you know you can make a way out of no way. There are resources beyond our imaginations. As elected leaders, I know you are aware of the historical and current practices social of race that impact policy and development. I know that you are also aware of the opening of the task force's report, which states on the road to equity, and if you haven't had a chance to read it, this opening passage alone will catch your attention. The overrepresentation of children, families, and communities of color in Oregon's foster care system represents a serious social injustice and economic emergency. It also offers an opportunity for the state to lead the charge in eliminating this persistent and complex nationwide challenge. Passing HB 2053 will be a key first step to help ensure family stability and child safety for all children and families in Oregon. Indeed, I know you are people with vision, and when we vision, we have to vision not just 5 years out, but 30 years out to what we are going to be as a state and how wonderful we will look in 30 years. So our programs need to plan in that future capacity. The imperative today is to take the intentional steps. Vision is one thing, intentional steps are another. House Bill 2053 is one of those first, very intentional steps that will lead to healthy and whole families and children in this state that all may have life, as we would say, have it abundantly. Thank you for your work and for hearing our testimony.
And thank you for your work, and thanks for being on the commission, and I know you've been a wonderful asset there. Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Yes. Reverend Knudsen, I appreciate all your work on task force, but I need to establish your credibility. Can you just tell us a little bit about your education?
Sure. Graduate of the University of Oregon, Franklin High School in Portland.
Franklin High School, that's what I was getting to.
Is that right?
And he's managed to overcome that. I think that's pretty impressive.
Unlike others we know.
Well, now I can see that you're having trouble remembering me. That's why you're not as astonished as these people are up here that I'm sitting up here. But if you remembered me, you'd be quite surprised that I'm sitting up here.
I do remember.
And you are.
Those are...
Well, your services have been recommended to me by my colleague here, and so I'll come up and we'll reconnect after church.
All right.
Thank you.
There's a little more education beyond that, but that's good enough for now. Thank you.
We have several other people who have signed up to speak here, so we're going to move on. We have several other bills, so I'm going to move on to Lon Getlin and Midge Purcell. Hi, Midge.
And Chair Weller coming up. I was honored to serve with the Reverend on the board of the Northwest Health Foundation, and he's truly one of the extraordinary citizens of this state. He's amazing.
That's great.
Good morning.
Welcome. Good morning. Thank you for coming today. Just introduce yourself and start.
I shall. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. And I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 2053. We believe that it is an important step on Oregon's road to eliminate racial disparities that are endemic in the child welfare system, both nationally and in the state. Inequities that was highlighted by a report that we put out last year called The State of Black Oregon. The Child Welfare Equity Task Force, which you've been discussing today, that was appointed by Governor Kulongowski to finally address the issue of disproportionality, confirmed and updated our findings in that report. They confirmed that 19.7% of all children in the foster care system were children of color, despite making up only 10% of all of Oregon's children. As it was stated today, in particular, African American and Native American children are overrepresented in the system, with African American children accounting for 8.3% of the child welfare population, although they only 2.4% of the population. And Native Americans comprising 8.8% of children in foster care, although they are only 1.3% of the child population. Disproportionality in foster care, as Pastor Knutson just stated, is caused by multiple factors. Internal inequities in the system, like policies and practice that may be culturally biased, and family risk factors like unemployment, single parenthood, and poverty. But as the task force points out, what has perpetuated this unacceptable system and outcomes is lack of accountability and a mandate and the will to improve the responsiveness of the system and eliminate disparities. Foster care is in Oregon is generally in decline, except for children of color. We believe that Oregon can and must do better. Ensuring that kids are of color are safe, but increasing their abilities to stay within their families and communities makes sense. It makes fiscal sense by minimizing future costs to the state. If children leave the system with opportunity, better self-esteem, and the support they need to succeed. And I also would like to also point out that behind the grim statistics are the faces of families, families that call our organization for help and support, families that have been separated too often and too long. Some of them are seniors raising their grandchildren. The Urban League runs a senior services center. And we hear from seniors who have inexplicably been unable to gain custody of their children and suffered terribly as their children and their grandchildren were taken into care and out of the community. Finally, DHS has made commendable progress. They have listened to the community and have begun to implement culturally specific services that we believe will have an impact in reducing disparities in the child welfare system. This legislation is an important part of that process, an important part of the mandate to change the prospects and outcomes of children of color who find themselves in the child welfare system. I urge you to support this legislation.
Thank you so much for coming.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lon Getlin. I'm a member of the Disproportionality Task Force. I came to the task force as a representative of foster care parents. I'm currently the CEO of a corporation in Portland, a 33-year-old corporation. It's really my experience in foster care over the past 25 years, both in California and Oregon, that makes my service to the task force and my testimony today hopefully germane to the issue. For over the past 25 years, my wife and I have had maybe 2 or 3 months where we did not have a foster child in our home. We chose to have only one foster child at a time because we understand that children in foster care need special care. They are all broken. That's why they're in foster care. We also had almost exclusively African-American boys in our home. Those boys tended to stay with us for a much longer period of time than normally a child stays in foster care. I'll tell you briefly about three of those foster care children, three African-Americans. Between the three of them, they spent over 10 years in our home. One of them was with us when he was from age 10 to 12. That youngster now, incidentally, all three of these boys refer to my wife and me as their mother and father because we're really the only mother and father they've had. The first boy who was with us from age 10 to 12 is currently a resident in prison in Ontario. The second youngster just aged out of the foster care system. He was an Oregon Youth Authority ward, if you will. Oregon Youth Authority refers, I think, pejoratively to those people as youths. That young man was with us from age 15 to 18. We're still very close to him and help support him. Before he came to us, he was in between 25 and 30 foster homes in Washington and in Oregon. A third African-American young man came to us from the inner city in Portland. Very difficult to work with during his first year, but got his act together, ultimately graduated from Westland High School, went on to the University of Oregon, and in 2009 graduated from USC's law school and is now a lawyer in Oregon. I mention these things to establish, hopefully, some credibility in three points I want to make to you. First of all, from a foster parent's perspective, I understand better than most people you're going to talk to about the goods and evils that we find in the foster care system. I also have extraordinary experience for a white guy in raising African-American children. And finally, if African-Americans believe that they are judged differently in every aspect of their lives than their white neighbors, I'm here to tell you that that's true, because I have often seen it with our own African-American foster children. Now, it's one thing, I believe, if African-Americans have to deal with these issues in their community as a whole. It is quite another thing, I believe, for families to lose their children to foster care at a rate that's disproportionate to white families who are in similar circumstances because of institutional racism for which the government and its institutions is responsible both for its existence and responsible to eradicate it. I use the term institutional racism not as something of my own making, but rather as the conclusion of the task force after 18 months of hard work and study and evaluation. I want to briefly describe what it's like to have been a member of that extraordinary group of people and the work we did. But first, I'd like to establish three facts for you to consider when you're thinking about whether or not you want to support this legislation. Two of those facts we've already discussed, and the statistics for the number of African-American, Native American children in foster care relative to the white population. So I won't go into that. But I want one thing that hasn't been mentioned today is this. According to all the studies and the evidence that we were presented with as task force members by professionals who earn their living at studying this kind of thing, if you have white families and black families who live under the same circumstances, be they poverty, single-parent homes, educational levels, or any other criteria that you might think would be relevant at first glance. If, in other words, all things being equal, rates of abuse or neglect against African American or Native American kids are no higher than white families. No difference. So why then do we have this issue.
You know, I know you've written material, and we have other hearings. If you could sum it up, that would be terrific, or give us your written material so we can share it with the rest of us.
Sure. I'm going to move, I'll sum it up, but I'm going to move this to the last statement that I think is really critically, critically important. And it's a plea to all of you, because we want your support, obviously, of this bill. We're in difficult times, and every nickel that we spend is scrutinized, and all legislators are in competition for all dollars. In such an environment, it would be easy and understandable for any legislator to take the position that disproportionality is some other legislator's problem or some other community's problem and vote against the bill. But I believe that one of the great joys of life is to rise above a challenge where it is in our own best interest and vote for, do things that are to the betterment of society as a whole. This is one of those occasions. Disproportionality and its effect on families and children and ultimately on society itself is inexcusable and it's intolerable. And we have to do things to eliminate it. Just as no legislator would tolerate injustice perpetrated against his own child, neither should that legislator allow an injustice to happen to anybody else's child just because he lives in a different part of the state. So when it comes to this matter, we believe that there's no difference between any of us. It's a situation that must be corrected. Thank you very much. Hope for your support.
Thank you very much, both of you, and thank you for the work that you do. And
sure.
I also, as a foster parent, and I can appreciate the agony and the joy also that goes with
that. Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have somebody else here? Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on, we've lost 2053, and open the one where the woman is, open the public hearing on 3037. I hope that lady is still here. Terrific. And we are carrying over, Becky, I bet that's what you're here for, 2107.
Yeah.
We're carrying that over.
Okay.
We won't be hearing that today.
All right, thank you.
And we will be having a work session on 2856 and a public hearing and hopefully a work session on 2314. Welcome, and I'm sorry that I kept you waiting.
That's fine. Thank you, Co-Chair Tomei. My name is Kay Metzger. I am the Chair of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and the Director of Senior and Disabled Services, and I thank you for taking a few moments to hear my brief comments about the Oregon Project Independence. I will echo the support of Representative Cowan and James Tave's comments about the program and support the role that OPI has in the continuum of care for seniors. We have found at a local level that indeed it does serve to prevent and delay the need for more costly services through Medicaid. And I can say that because, in fact, my agency 2 years ago did a study on the number of people that we had applying for Medicaid services that appeared to be eligible for long-term care services. And we found that when given a choice, 8% of those folks chose to use OPI services instead of going on to Medicaid. And this saves the state money by virtue of the fact that OPI does cap the number of hours that a person can receive in their own home per month, and it builds on the support of the family and the community. And then additionally, OPI does not pay for health insurance, and I think that's important. When a person goes on Medicaid, they receive coverage through the Oregon Health Plan, and OPI does not cover any health insurance costs. Most, of course, of the recipients have Medicare services and other supplemental insurances, but since it doesn't pay for health insurance, it does save the money for the state in that way. So there are significant savings through the program. We support the intent of Bill 3037 to not alter the in-home services and that the in-home services are a priority. However, it's our hope that there will be some kind of vehicle to further the ability to impact the number of people accessing Medicaid long-term care through the provision of evidence-based services such as chronic disease management, options counseling, and health promotion, if indeed there are funds that would allow that. In our experience in trying to implement person-centered planning, we found that it's important to assess the situation, the individual strengths of the situation, and then customize the approach and the interventions that would best meet the needs and to hopefully keep people independent and in their own homes. So we are hopeful that there will be some vehicle to do this in the future. So thank you.
Thank you for waiting, and thanks for your testimony, and thank you for the work you do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, I'm closing public hearing on 3037. With that, I'm also opening a work session on 2856. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2856, excuse me, has been heard in two different hearings, March 2nd and March 7th. The original language required the Department of Human Services to create a pilot program with the goal of establishing a uniform audit process to encompass all information required by the department and other state or local entities, in addition to allowing abbreviated and less frequent audits for programs after several consecutive successful audits. DHS will report the findings of the pilot program the next Legislative Assembly. We do have Dash 4 amendments to this measure. The Dash 4 amendments eliminates the requirement to establish a pilot program, but rather requires the department to coordinate with other state and local entities ways to reduce administrative and resource burdens on providers through uniform processes, reporting forms, and sharing of information. It requires the department to evaluate the success of the processes and forms implemented under the measure. And additionally, the department is to appoint a work group to use a continuous improvement process to review state reporting requirements that duplicate or exceed federal requirements or are unnecessary and may implement any of the changes to administrative rules recommended by the work group. We have received no revenue impact statement and a no fiscal impact statement on the Dash 4 amendments.
Welcome, representatives. So do you want to talk to us? Well, we've heard briefly about the Dash 4 amendments. Let's see if there are any questions of anyone about the Dash 4 amendments. So, all right, are we ready to vote on this, colleagues? Yes.
If Representative Nathanson would like to discuss the Dash 4s, I mean, I'd like to hear how they came about and everything from her,
okay.
But I appreciate her bringing this bill to us. It's a very good bill.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. After listening to the public testimony, I listened very carefully. Of course, the providers had compelling testimony about 44 desk audits on the part of one, 66 reports on the part of another. The problem really is widespread for providers across the state. But I also listened very carefully to the Department of Human Services about what they're doing, what they thought the language of the bill said, how they thought the language of the bill could be improved, and especially how we could make sure that the bill accomplished the purposes that I had outlined in the bill, but also fit in with what they thought the language should say. So I'll just briefly tell you. First of all, one word can sometimes make a big difference. We changed one word that said collaborate. We changed it to coordinate because we're talking about not just yakking with each other and talking, which is collaborating. They wanted a word that they felt would be stronger. They want to make sure that agencies will actually actively coordinate. So we changed that word. We also added a brief statement that makes sure that agencies will actually share information and data with each other. That is key to reducing the number of reports they ask for. If one shares a report with another, then the second one doesn't have to ask for the information in the second report. So we added the little section on requiring that they actually share that information with each other. We also clarified that audits is used more broadly. It means various kinds of audits, performance audit, financial audit, compliance audit. We didn't want people getting around this by saying, well, it's this kind of audit, not that kind of audit. We wanted to make sure to capture everything. We acknowledged that the department is already engaged in a continuous improvement process, and we, I think a critical point is we removed the reference to a pilot project. The agency advises us that they are already engaged in the continuous improvement process. We're saying this isn't a pilot project, just roll up your sleeves and get it done. So we did broaden the language some, but we think that it also hones it in to say there are a lot of administrative burdens that providers are feeling and a lot of administrative burdens that agencies feel from each other. What this is saying is this is one piece. This bill says this piece is something that you should work on and just get it fixed. We can continue worrying about and thinking about a broad array of things, but this is one. It's time now to fix this one.
It's a great first step.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. Yep. Yep. So now we're ready to vote. Oh, good. Representative.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2856, dated 3-11-11.
Chair Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendment, stated 3-11-11. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Dash 4 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I hope you'll entertain my motion that House Bill 2856, as amended, go to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves that House Bill 2856, as amended, go to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to thank the representative again, and as a body, this is the kind of stuff we need to be doing. I mean, this, even the cookie bill that we passed the other day was a simple bill, but it's a cleanup bill and something we should be doing and addressing this sort of thing. So this could is the next cookie mill, too. Bill.
Right.
I can't believe you got the cookie bill.
Yeah,
in there.
I need to grow up.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Would you take...
I just want to echo the same thing because we sat through an education hearing this last week where we heard about the 92 mandates that school districts have to chase. And as we look at all of our agencies and the cost involved in these things, and when you read testimony that came to this committee about $320,000 for one nonprofit to respond, I have to wonder what it cost DHS and school, you know, OD and all these agencies to put that out for people to respond to. That's a lot of money not getting to the front line. So thank you for untangling this for us.
Very good. Okay, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative White.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feather.
Yes.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required votes, this House Bill 2856 is passed. And Representative, will you carry it on the floor? Great. Thank you so much. Good job, committee. So now,
we have no one to sign up for the public hearing.
Okay. We're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 2314. I'm going to let her give the summary. Pardon?
Yes, could I state, Sahara, right? I think I testified on this bill. It's a bill to accommodate the fact that school social workers are now able to be trained and licensed by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and it's to make sure that as they practice in the schools, they don't run afoul of the clinical social worker bill that we passed in the last session. The Dash 2 amendments are at the request of the agency, and they're only intended to straighten out a slight wording problem that was caused in the original bill, and it just makes it clear that what is required for the qualification of a clinical social worker. Just taking the opportunity to use a convenient relating to clause.
Great. Good. Okay, so this bill would exempt school social workers from licensing requirements of clinical social workers. So, any more in the public hearing? I think I might close it up a work session. Okay, with everybody, close the public hearing on 2314. and open up a work session on House Bill 2314. Representative?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2314.
Dash 1 or Dash 2?
We need both.
We need both? We need
both? Which are the Dash 1?
Yes, please.
Representative Greenlee, the Dash 1s are the ones that replace the original measure. So,
do you want to take a break? Do we need to do
that? Dash 1s are the ones that do what?
It was a gut and stuff. Your Dash 1s were a gut and stuff.
Oh, I see. To do this.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know,
stuff
sounds very brutal, but actually what it is, it sort of takes a relating clause and an old bill, and then it puts a new bill in there. So that's called, you're gutting the old bill and you're stuffing in a new bill. So, Representative.
My motion stands.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2314. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Further, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2314.
Chair Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2314. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 2314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will again call the roll, please.
Representative White.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Greenlee. Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Fletcher.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2314, as amended, passes and goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Greenlee, will you carry this?
I'd love to. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. We are moving along, you guys. All right. Our last bill is a public hearing on House Bill 3536, which I will open the hearing on.
For the session? Our last bill for the session?
You wish.
Yeah, you wish.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3536 requires the Oregon Health Authority to suspend medical assistance for inmates of public institutions.
Okay. We have Paul Snyder, John Howell, Cindy Becker, and Gina Nichols on here, too, if she can. Okay, we'll have you. Okay. Okay, folks, moving up. Jennifer, go ahead.
I did.
Oh, you did. All right. Who wants to go first? Okay, Cindy.
Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Director of Clackamas County's Health, Housing, and Human Services Department. And I want to thank you very much for your leadership on this bill, and I'm just really pleased that the entire committee signed on to this bill, which must mean it's a good thing. I also think, for me, it's really interesting, and I've mentioned this before, where 40 years ago I was in college protests running from the police, and now I'm channeling them in support of this bill, in the sheriff's office particularly. So everything that goes around comes around. But this is something that's small but very meaningful. What happens when people are arrested and incarcerated, go to jail at the local level, and they are on medical assistance, their medical assistance is terminated. And when they come out of jail, they have to reapply for medical assistance, which can take up to 2 to 3 to 4 months. And people who are on standard, if they go in, if they're arrested and go into jail and they come out, they can't get back on standard. And so what happens is, as you know, many people who are incarcerated have mental illness and co-occurring disorders of addictions. And so, and oftentimes, particularly when you're talking about misdemeanors, folks go through a vicious cycle of being arrested, let out, and rearrested again. One of the issues is that when they go into jail, they do get treatment, they do get medications, but when they come out and they are no longer eligible for medical assistance, they have no way to pay for those medications, they have no way to pay for that treatment, and they end up in hospitals and they end up back in jail again. The loss of Medicaid benefits can interrupt, delay, limit, or even prevent access to community treatment services. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has urged states, also the former director of Secretary of Health and Human Services at the federal level, has urged states to suspend eligibility while people are incarcerated rather than terminate them. This is at the state's discretion. The federal government allows this. Other states have done it. It's really, from where I sit, a no-brainer for people, particularly for individuals who are incarcerated for 12 months or less, and that is, I would say, 99.9% of the people who are at local jails are incarcerated for much less than 12 months. We want those people, when they get back on the street, to be able to get the medications and the treatment that they need. One of the things that I wanted to... I've asked our folks, we have folks who work in the jail, and I asked them to talk about how important this was, and it was really critical. And what they say is they see the cycle repeated over and over again. People are arrested, they stay in jail, they lose their benefits, they go out on the street, they can't get what they need, they're back in jail again. We can stop this, you can stop this, and obviously it's something that you have signed on. Now, let me tell you something specifically about this bill. Some amendments are going to come to you because there was some technical things that needed to be changed. I was asked by the department, by the Oregon Health Authority, if we meant to have this bill result in them losing $40 million, and I said, no, that wasn't the intent of the bill. So there was a technical adjustment that we can fix. There's also some other technical adjustments that we're working on with your committee folks and folks with legislative counsel that would put this in motion for jail and then ask folks to come back and look at the prison population, what we can do about that. But I really thank you so much for signing on to this bill. It's really important. Again, it's one of the small things, but it's going to mean a lot to people across the state.
Thank you, Cindy.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties and appearing this morning in support of House Bill 3536. Ms. Becker, I think, did a great job of outlining the reasons for the legislation. One of the things that she mentioned was you start out in jail and then you wind up in jail, but it's important to recognize that there are a number of intermediate and very costly steps between the time you get out and the time you come back in. First and foremost is the cost to a victim of another crime. That's very difficult to calculate. But then there's the cost of the law enforcement unit that responds to the victim of the crime. Then there's the cost of the prosecutor. Then there's the cost of the defense lawyer. Then there's the cost of the court. Then there's the cost of the jail and community corrections. All these things are costs that can be avoided, and they really add up quite fast. So for those reasons and for the ones that she's already articulated, we support this bill.
Thank you, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent Oregon's 36 county sheriffs. Cindy can run, but she can't hide. This is a rap show.
Public confession.
Madam Chair and committee members, we think this bill makes sense, and the research we've done indicates that more and more states are moving to this policy of suspension as opposed to dropping them from Medicaid, and it simply speeds up the process of getting them continued medical care after leaving jail. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Madam Chair, can I say one thing? I do, for the record, I do have some testimony from Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, and do on record supporting this as well.
Terrific. Thank you. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative.
I'm just going to make a comment.
Yes.
First of all, thank you, Representative Tomei, for bringing this forward. I think it's a fabulous idea, and I think we're all on board because certainly we get it, right? It just, if you got folks, and from a personal experience, not me personally, but, you know, watching someone come out of one of our state correctional facilities, and we send them out with a morning after pill, but we don't send them out with enough to meds to keep them going. And the destabilization of a mental health patient is fast, very fast. And some of the meds that we, you know, prescribe while they're incarcerated are then come out and can't afford those same meds because they're not on the generic list or they're not. So now we're talking about having to switch people around. And to get into some of our county services is absolutely extraordinary. Some of the wait lists, that little critical two-week supply or three-week supply or whatever it is we send folks out with, if they're coming out and experiencing the real world again, and they just get hit with kind of the bright lights of what's going on in the world around them, they're not going to move through the system fast enough to get back on board, to be stabilized again, and to actually be productive in a way that's meaningful. And so what you do wind up with is folks back in the prison system again and again and again. This is a really simple fix, and if you know, with all of us on it, I think this is the first bill this session where the entire committee's on board. So, you know, kudos to everybody on this board for doing it.
Oh, thank you, Representative Parrish.
Representative.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Chair Tomei. Thank you, Chair Tomei. We don't have to discuss this here, but I assume either in the amendments or by rulemaking or wherever it is, by the way, thanks for taking time out of Consumer Protection to come over here today. How we reconnect is important. It doesn't. I'm not saying it has to be in the bill, but I'm sure we're thinking about that, correct? Once they get out, how do they reconnect? That's, you don't have to answer the question, but I just hope we got the details worked out.
Mr. Kutcher, when you say reconnect to Medicaid or to services?
To whatever coverage that they are entitled to once they're released.
And that will be done basically that the folks who determine eligibility, Oregon Health Authority and also Department of Human Services, will be able to just basically turn it back on again. They won't have to reapply. They're currently eligible to turn it back on, and we and the counties are also working with folks as they leave jail to reconnect them to the services as well.
And just a quick follow-up. So you obviously have a lot of confidence that that's going to happen and that they know how to do that.
I do.
Good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have Gina Nichol. Thank you, Gina. Last but not least.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, my name is Gina Nichol. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Good bill. Do pass with the amendments. I just wanted to address Representative Gilliam's questions. We've actually had this conversation, and so we have sat down with the DOC, and we have a memorandum. So we're going to hope that next year we can come back with a bill to add DOC into this. But for right now, please, this would make our lives so much easier and cost-effective. It would really save money and time. Thank you.
And it's humane. It's
yes.
The people who are coming out of these institutions.
Yes.
All the other things. Yes. So thank you very much. And I suppose there's nobody here else willing to testify. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing. But before I do, I want to say, good job, committee. We did a lot today. Yeah, right on. So with that, I'll close House Bill 3536 and close the House Committee on Human Services.